We're trying to study the book of Ruth. We're already 4 weeks into this study, and I've had one study in 4 weeks. Altogether, I'll have 6 studies out of 10. That just shows you how much interruption there's going to be, and so we've got some ground to cover. And yet, since it's been 3 weeks since we've talked about the book of Ruth, we need to perhaps review some of the things that we've already studied, and that's exactly what we want to do. If we can go ahead and get started, Buzz, if you'll be in charge of getting the slide. How do you introduce the book of Ruth? Open up your Bibles to the end of the book of Ruth, and there that's the introduction to it. You get to the last 4 verses of the book of Ruth. Ruth is on page 826 in my Bible, if that's of any help to you. And so if you'll look at those 4 closing verses that are there, these are the generations of Perez. Perez begat Hezron. Hezron begat Ram. Ram begat Amminadab. Amminadab begat Nahshon. Nahshon begat Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz. Boaz begat Obed. Obed begat Jesse. And Jesse begat David. What a way to end the book. Who on earth is Perez? Well, does this sound like Matthew 1 to you? He begat, he begat, he begat. I want you to look in Matthew chapter 1 and find the name other than Boaz and Obed and Jesse and David. I want you to find one of those characters in Matthew chapter 1 that mentions the name of the wife of one of these men. Now, I'm not talking about Ruth. I'm talking about another character that you know in the Bible, but you may have never ever associated that in the begats. You begin looking and you read there, and of course it begins with Abraham, and then it says, "And Judah begat Perez," and that's the Greek spelling of this Perez that's in the Old King James over there. And Perez, and Perez begat Hezron. Hezron begat Ram. Ram begat Amminadab. And Amminadab begat Nahshon. And Salmon begat Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz by... Isn't that amazing? Who on earth did Salmon marry? That's amazing. That's Rahab. And so you begin looking at the genealogy of David, and you run across 2 women right here in these closing verses of Ruth chapter 4, and that is Salmon, who's married to Rahab, and there's Ruth, who is married to Boaz. That's the genealogy of this book. Now, you know Rahab, do you not? And so this gives us a time reference in order to study the book of Ruth. I just think it is amazing that we never recognize how close Ruth was to knowing knowing Rahab. I mean, you look at it and you begin looking at the genealogy that is there, and you go from Boaz. And Boaz's daddy was Salmon. Who was Salmon married to? Rahab. Isn't that amazing? I mean, you start looking at the genealogy that's here, and it really, really gets interesting in relationship to the chronology of that. And that's just a tidbit. It may be a tidbit of interest, of something that you may have never noticed. Now then, if you look at the book of Ruth there, go ahead and look at that next slide. There are some people and places names that you will recognize. If I say Bethlehem, Judah, that's the Old King James reference that's found in the book of Ruth. Then you've got Moab, and you've got Elimelech and Naomi. You've got Malhon and Chilion. And then who is this person that is associated with Ruth? You see her name, TV personality. When you see that, are you tempted to think of Oprah? When Oprah came onto the scene, I thought, somebody's looking for a Bible name, misspelled Oprah's name, and that may be where that's happened. This is Orpah. And who on earth is this woman? She's going to be mentioned in the book of Ruth. And I say all of this to help us recognize, we may think that we know the book of Ruth, and we may not really, really know the book of Ruth. I've got on the next line, no longer Naomi, but Mara. Who on earth in the book of Ruth is called Mara? Well, since it's associated with no longer Naomi, you know who it is. But why on earth would Naomi change her name from Naomi to Mara? That's part of this that we're going to study about in the book of Ruth. And then, of course, you've got Boaz and Obed and Jesse and David. Now, you look at you begin looking at the text. Go back to the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. It came to pass in the days in which the judges ruled. Now then, we've got a historical setting for the book of Ruth. These are the events that happened when the judges were ruling. Now, the question is, Where do the judges fit in? Well, let's briefly look at the Old Testament history to set up the period of the judges. If you go back to the time they left the land of Egypt, you know that story. You know the story about them leaving the land of Egypt. Go ahead and look at that map, and you'll see where they crossed the Red Sea, which is the next slide, Buzz, if we could have that. And from there, let's go down two more slides. Now they get down to a place called Rephidim, and from there they get down to Mount Sinai, which is the next slide. And so that's the Exodus. That's the 40 year, that's the beginning of the 40-year Exodus from the land of Egypt. Judges are not here yet. This is the time the nation of Israel is being formed. So we're trying to give a geographical, historical setting for the book of Ruth. And so you've got them, they get to Mount Sinai. I think it is important for us to recognize that they spent 1 year at Mount Sinai, and I would encourage you to try to remember four things that happened during that period of time. We're not always aware. We think they go to Mount Sinai and they immediately leave. They stay there for an entire year. And while they are there, they obviously get the law. There's the incident of the golden calf. There is the time spent in building the tabernacle. And so that's part of the reasons they were there for a year. Can you imagine how massive that building was and how long it would have taken them to construct it? And then this is where we get the number of the people. And so those are the four things that happen whenever they get to Mount Sinai. When the Lord says, leave Mount Sinai and head for the promised lands, the next slide shows you the 11 days journey it is from Mount Sinai to get to the promised land. On the southern edge down there is a place called Kadesh Barnea, and that's where they arrive. It only takes 11 days. They've got to recognize they've been a year at Mount Sinai. They spend less than 2 weeks, and there they're ready to go into the promised land. Well, you know the story, how tragically they decided to send spies in who came back, many of them, most of them, 10 of the 12, with a negative report saying, we cannot take this land. It's impossible for us to take this land. There are giants in the land. The walls reach up to the heavens and everything. So you've got to understand they came back and a lack of faith. And as a result of this, they spent the next 40 years wandering in the wilderness. And we mentioned this when we studied before, because here's a tidbit that I was a long time recognizing. I'm not sure, growing up in West Huntsville, talking about 40 years in the wilderness, but what I thought they got up and packed their suitcases every day to move. I mean, you know, that's what you do on vacation, isn't it? When it's a traveling vacation, you get up and you repack the car and everything and get ready to go. So they spent 40 years. The reality is the Bible lists 40 places they visit. And so when we talk about 40 years in the wilderness, it's not every day, 365, they're aimlessly wandering around in that wilderness. They go to 40 different places, and those places are enumerated by name. And you may get some indication about the conditions or what the people were thinking about by the names of those places, but the geographical location of them, no one knows. So at the end of 40 years, they come back up to Kadesh Barnea, and now they're ready to go into the promised land. However, there are those individuals in that who would keep them, because originally they had wanted to go this way. Moses is still alive. They want to go this way. The Edomites will not let them pass through. They told the Edomites, said, "We whatever damage we do as we pass through that land, we will reimburse you for any damage that we've done." Well, the Edomite says, "No, you cannot do it." Now then, who are the Edomites? They are an important nation in the Old Testament. Where do they come from? If I tell you that the Edom was known by another name, and his name, he was a twin. How many twins do you know in the Bible? You know Rehoboam and his twin brother Jeroboam, which is not true. I just grew up thinking that anybody whose names rhymes must be twins, and so when I read the Bible as a child about Rehoboam and Jeroboam, I decided they were almost identical twins. For the longest time, I could not tell the difference between those identical twins. You know, which one was the son of Solomon and which one was not. And you may have a problem trying to figure out which one is the son of Solomon. I've told you, I remember everything crooked in my head. You want a crooked way to remember it? The father of one of these boys was Solomon. Which letter, J for Jeroboam, or R for Rehoboam, is closest to S? And somebody said, "Why don't you just remember it?" Because I cannot remember it any other way. Rehoboam is the son of Solomon, and so that's where. Well, they're not twins. The other guy, the other twin in the Bible. Didymus, Thomas Didymus. You know what Didymus means? The twin. There is Thomas, he was a twin. But there's another set of twins in the Bible, and if I tell you the first name, you'll know the first one. Jacob and Esau. And so, who are the Edomites? The other name for Esau is Edom. And you would have thought God, having delivered them and having the knowledge of all that's transpired and their desire just to go right up in this area and take the promised land, the Edomite says, "You cannot do it." Evidently, because of that, depends on which map you look at, they came all the way down to this other arm of the Red Sea. Ezion Geber. And they had to circumvent up this area to get into the promised land. Now the other tribe that is there is of importance in the book of Ruth, and that is Moab. Where do the Moabites come from? The Edomites are cousins of the Jews. The Moabites, it might help you if you think of them being maybe the great nephew of the Jews, because Moab is a descendant of Lot. When God comes down in the days of Abraham and destroys Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot's daughters get him drunk and have a child, each of them consecutive nights, the conception is, and they have two sons. And these two names are important in the Bible, because not only would you read about the Moabites, you'll read about the Ammonites. And so those are the descendants of Lot. They're the cousins of the Jews. I call them, in my mind, the nephews of the Jews, because Lot was Abraham's nephew. And so they're all ethnically related. And they've each of them become powerful nations. And the Moabites and the Edomites are often in the Bible, the Edomites even more so than the Moabites. And so what happens is they come up this land. If you'll show that next slide, Moses comes up in this area, and there is that whole east bank of the, go ahead and look at the next map if you would. There's this whole land that Moses helps them conquer. We're sometimes not aware of that when we think about the Jews taking the promised land, and we see the map that shows where all of the 12 tribes were settled. We think, well, that's what Joshua did. No, Moses does this side on this side, and then Moses dies here at Mount Nebo, and he's 120 years of age, and he was able to stand on the top of this mountain and see the Mediterranean Sea. Tim, you like to travel. That's a place you ought to go on a clear day to see how good your eyesight is at your age compared to Moses' eyesight when he was 120 years of age. He was still a young man. The Bible describes him in that respect. His eye was not dimmed, and that's probably not true of any of us in this auditorium. But his eyes, and he could see all the way over to and saw the Mediterranean Sea. He saw all the promised land. I'm not sure exactly how far north he could have seen from there, but there are those mountain peaks that are up here in Lebanon. And so at that time, there was very little air pollution and everything. You could see a lot farther than you could in our day and everything. So Moses dies, and it takes them 7 years to conquer this land. When Joshua takes Moses' place, they immediately come over to the promised land. They first go south before they go north, and it takes them 7 years to conquer the promised land. Yes, Bubba.
I know you're a fan of these, but do you know how to remember?
Beg your pardon? Yes, Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh. That's one sentence for me. How do you remember it?
You think of the sandwich. It's a Reuben on Gad, half Manasseh.
All right. You are crazy. Anybody has put it in your head that way is crazy. And I know a real, real crazy guy, and he's not sitting out back. He's standing up front. The Reuben guy ate over there on the east bank. If that'll help you remember Reuben, Gad, and the half of the tribe of Manasseh. Anyway, you begin looking at this land. Now they get into the land. Well, why didn't the Lord just give them all of that land at one time? It took them, 7 days to get Jericho, and they could have marched right in almost, except that was not God's original plan. The Lord could have given them every bit of that land immediately. Now, if the Lord had sent some plague, and he could have done that and wiped out that nation. In fact, the Bible said he sent hornets before them to get these people so they were disquieted when the Jews were coming in. So before the Jews ever got into that promised land, the Lord sent hornets. I don't know if you've ever been stung by a hornet. You take all of the venom from one beehive that has, 3,000 bees in it and put it in one hornet, and that's what a hornet stings like. I mean, that's not scientific, but if you've ever heard a hornet sting, you know what I'm talking about. And that's what he sent in. He sent in hornets to disquiet the people. Why did he not give it all to them? Well, what would happen to any house that is left by itself for 7 years? You ever think about that? You go on an extended vacation and you come back, what's your lawn look like? Can you imagine what your house would look like in 7 years? And so it's a part of the wisdom of God, and he may have done it for some other reason, But it's sure a lot, a whole lot better for them to gradually take this land and continue to move up and up and up, and they took all of the land. In fact, the Bible says they took all of the land from the river Euphrates, which is not on this map, but if you see where that marker is above that, that's the river Euphrates, all of the land to a smaller river that comes right in here called the River of Egypt. They took every bit of that land. Joshua 21, verse 43 through 45 says, every promise God had made was fulfilled. They took all of the promised land. Now, some of the tribes did not drive out the nations as they were supposed to, and that became a problem later on. And that's why whenever you look down at the bottom, you see Simeon in that green circle down at the bottom. Simeon was the most negligent of the tribes, and so they really never had any land that you could really call, that was the land that Simeon dwelt in. He was given that land down in that area, but he really failed to take all of that land. So sometimes, as you look at Bible maps and you get down here where Simeon is, it'll be marked in various ways down there because of, depending on what maps and who's drawing the maps in relationship to that. They're in the promised land. They've got to have judges. Look in the book of Judges for a discussion of the things that transpired during the period of the judges. You look early in the book of Judges, and you'll read the statement about the people were faithful to God for the entirety of the of that land, of the time when I'm in the book of Joshua. That's why I could not find it. You'll see. Look in chapter 2 and verse 7. Judges chapter 2 and verse 7. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all of the days of the elders who outlived Joshua. Who's that? Well, how many, who are the two oldest men in the promised land? One of them's Joshua, and the other's Caleb. Caleb says he's 85 years of age whenever he gets over into the promised land, which meant that 40 years before, when he'd gone out as a spy, he was about 40. Joshua lived to be 110. We don't know exactly how old Joshua was when he was sent out as a spy. Perhaps if he's 40, then you've got 70 years of the life of Joshua, but there's a 40-year section in there. So you got about 30 years or so that they're faithful to God. Now the elders who outlived Joshua were those men who were 20 years and younger when they left the land of Egypt. They're the tribe, they're the nation that went in and took the promised land. And so we've got all the days of Joshua, and then you've got all the days of those elders who used to be under 20 years of age when they left the land of Egypt. They were the ones that went in. Only two men above 20 years of age entered into the promised land. These guys are much younger than Joshua and Caleb, and they're faithful to God. What is tragic is the Lord told through Moses, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, one God. And then he says, and these things you shall teach them to your children when you're sitting in your house, when you're walking by the way, when you're lying down, and when you're getting up. The most important thing Moses said to that generation, who, whenever Moses said these words, were about ready to enter into the promised land. Remember, Moses dies at Mount Nebo. It's in the shadow of Mount Nebo that Moses says, you teach these things diligently to your children. And they did not do it. Any church is one generation from being extinct. You've got to understand that. Palm Beach Lakes is celebrating 100 years, and we owe a debt to generation after generation of individuals who were here and passed that torch down to us. But they failed to do it. And so you read in the next verse about Joshua, how old he was and where they buried him. Look in verse 10, Judges chapter 2 and verse 10. When all that generation had gathered their fathers, another generation arose after them which did not know the Lord, nor the work that the Lord had done for Israel. And so now you get on a roller coaster of ungodliness during the period of Judges. Why is this important in relationship to studying the Book of Ruth? Because Ruth lives at a time in which the people are faithful to God as long as there is a deliverer, a judge. But no sooner does that judge die, like they were faithful all the days of Joshua, no sooner does that judge die than the people turn back to ungodliness. And as a result of that, the Lord did as He had promised, and He brought plagues upon them. And so that's where you are when you get to the study of this Ruth. Let's look at Ruth chapter 1. Let's go back to two or three slides down is the text. In the days when the judges ruled, we do not know which judge was ruling at this time. Josephus, a Jewish historian, says it was during the time of Eli. That is not a biblical commentary. That is Josephus writing about this event. And he specifies the particular judge. Could it have been Eli? Yes. Could it have not been Eli? Yes. So the reality is, let's stay with the text. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. Now, the book of Deuteronomy said, if you're not faithful to me, I'm going to send plagues on you. I'm going to bring adversity in your life. And so while it is not specified, it is possible, perhaps even probable, that when we get to the book of Ruth, it was one of those down periods of time when the Lord had sent a famine. Now there is, in that period when the judges ruled, there was a famine of the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah. Are you aware there was more than one Bethlehem in the promised land? This is Bethlehem. And if you look back at that previous slide, there's no need to put it up there. Where's Bethlehem? It's in Judah. It's where the tribe of Judah settled. And so in Bethlehem, there's a man that is there, and there was the famine, and he goes and sojourns in the land of Moab. As you begin thinking about this, you'll come to a realization of the fact that the time had come and there's a famine, and this man leaves the land that flows with milk and honey and goes to the land of Moab, because evidently the famine had not reached Moab. And so we read about him. His name is not yet given. And his wife and his two sons. Got a picture? Famine in the land. No way to make a living. He knows where there's land. Where the famine is not. So this man, and the name of this man, verse 2, is Elimelech. And Elimelech was the man's name, and his wife's name was Naomi. The name of his two sons were Malchon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah, and they came into the country of Moab and continued there. If you'll read a little bit later, you'll read in verse 4, the latter part of verse 4, that 10 years transpire. So during this 10-year period of time, Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, and Chilion are down in the land of Moab. And they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Here is the story of the book of Ruth, which you read this one verse about the 10 years, and you drop this verse out, we're reading about maybe 2 or 3 months of the life of Ruth. That's all there is. Here's the background of it. That's why you need to know those maps, not in that in great detail, but you need to know what's happened during the period of Judges. And they're there, and then we get a brief glimpse at the life of Ruth. And as you read this, they dwelt there about 10 years, and then Naomi's husband dies, as do her two sons. If you are a widow, how dependent are you on your children? Thank God that there are children who take seriously the caring of their mothers. It is interested in 1 Timothy chapter 5, we apply that verse to a man who does not provide for his family. For it is a generic truth that if a man does not provide for his own, who is he? What's he like? He's worse than an infidel. Wants to take a few minutes and focus on this aspect of this. If you look in 1 Timothy chapter 5, the church had a problem of trying to deal with widows. It's not just widows in Jerusalem who are there as a result of that are dealt with when those seven men are chosen. But in 1 Timothy chapter 5, you read about this starting in verse 3. Honor widows who are widows indeed. Honor widows who are really widows. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God. God places the primary responsibility to care for widows on children. And I think if you've got the old King James, there's another element. You have the old King James, you have the word nephews. Children, grandchildren, and the old King James translates this word grandchildren by nephews. Probably grandchildren is the better rendering of it, as the later translations show. But the family has primary obligation to take care of widows. And so now he's talking about those who are really widows. How are they to be taken care of? Now she who is really a widow and left alone trusts in God, continues in supplication and prayers night and day. That's what a real widow looks like, that is to be honored those who are widows indeed. There's a description of another group of widows. She who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. And so we've got two different classes of widows. You've got widows that are godly in their nature. They continue in supplication and prayers night and day. One of the real blessings of my life have been widows who said, "Dan, I pray for you every day of my life. I believe with all of my heart that I've been blessed by those people." There are widows in this church, both those who are deceased and those who are alive now, who have prayed for me or are praying for me every day. And that's not just for Dan, that's a prayer of supplication. And I hope it is a daily supplication. If you are a widow and you're sitting there in loneliness, here's some way you can spend your time. She is one who trusts in God, continues in supplication and prayers night and day. And he says, but here's the widow that lives in pleasure. She's not really a widow indeed that is to be honored. But if anyone does not provide for his own, especially those of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. We live in a day and an age in which we do everything we can, perhaps to avoid taking care of widows. How many widows are there in Palm Beach County, or in the world, but especially in Palm Beach County, whose family lives some distance away, and they may never even call mom any time at all? Maybe weeks, days or weeks between phone calls. The Bible says sons and grandsons have the primary responsibility in relationship to this. And God looks at you as being worse than an infidel if you don't take care of widows. Folks, we need to think soberly about this. This is God's plan. But says, do not let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number. That's interesting. You would have had to have lived in Ephesus to fully understand all that is involved when he says, here are widows that the church has no obligation toward them because they're living in pleasure. But here are some widows that are helped in a number, evidently in an ongoing kind of situation. Now, could the church help a widow who was under 60? Absolutely. Why? It has an obligation to do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. And so we need to understand that. But there was a number of individuals who were special in this respect, and they were not to be added to this number unless they were above 60s, and unless she has been the wife of one man. She must be well reported of for good works. She's brought up children. She's lodged strangers. She's washed the saints' feet. She has relieved the afflicted, and she has diligently followed every good work. What a description to describe older women in the church. When I begin thinking specifically about people in this, one name that comes to my mind that many of you would recognize would be Janet Hickerson. Do you know how diligent Janet Hickerson was in visiting folks in the hospital? You know how feeble she was even getting in the building with the wheelchair? You remember that? It was amazing to me when I would visit people in the hospital, and in the hospital, you know, you have to walk 4 miles to get to that room that's on the back side of the hospital, and the people would say to me over and again, well, Janet was just here yesterday or something. Widows have time on their hands, and they're trying to figure out how to use that time. And so here's this description of her. She's out being spiritual, doing these things. She's well reported of. She has entertained strangers. She's washed the saints' feet. She has relieved those who are afflicted. She's diligently followed every good works, but refuse younger women. Do not let them be those who are taken into the number, for when they have begun to grow wanton against Christ, they desire to marry and have in condemnation because they've cast off their first faith, and besides they learn to be idols. Here's the other description. Wandering about from house to house, not only idle, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things they ought not. In the church, in almost every congregation I know of, there are busybodies in the church. Oftentimes, they are widows. Sometimes they're single women. Sometimes they're women that have a husband, and they're neglected by their husband, and what do? They spend their time spreading gossip. And that's what's happening here. And it was happening there, and Paul says, that's not the one the church has an obligation to go, has that obligation. Then he says, therefore, I desire that younger women marry, bear children, manage the house, give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. For some have already turned after Satan. But if any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them and do not let the church be burdened. Primary obligation is not primarily to the church. It's primarily to sons and grandsons of widows. But there were widows that were taken care of in the number, whatever that is. I'm not sure. The Bible does not give specific details. But there were a group of women who were supported by the church and taken care of in some way. Let me say this, and we're not finished with this topic. I want to spend at least one class talking to widows, those who are widows in this church or who someday may be widows. I want you to see that Ruth and Naomi are not the only widows God's taken care of. And if your husband is old and frail, or perhaps you no longer have a husband, you need to understand the eyes of the Lord are over you in a very special way. Pure and undefiled religion is to doctrinally be sound, to know the Bible. Pure and undefiled religion is to visit the fatherless and widows in their afflictions. That's James 1, and that's a stopping place for today, and we'll take this up in the next class.